Welcome to episode 17 of Bibliotech, the podcast about emerging technologies for academics. This podcast is brought to you by University Affairs Magazine. My name is Rochelle Mazar, and I'm an emerging technologies librarian at the University of Toronto, Mississauga. Every month, you can listen in as I talk about what's new in technology and what we as academics should be paying attention to. It's hard to keep up with all the new software, tools, and gadgets. That's where I come in. What do Twitter, Tumblr, and citations have in common? In this episode, I look at what social media can teach us about plagiarism and citation. Citation used to make sense. When you had to walk into a library, find a run of a journal in the stacks, pull the bound volume listing the right year off the shelf, flip through to find the specific issue, and then get to the page number for the article you're looking for, it made sense to record that journey as a citation at the bottom of a page. A citation is literally the directions to retrace your steps and find the source you're using. You know, as you're walking through the library, scanning rows and rows of spines, storing thousands and thousands of articles, that without that citation information, without those precise directions, you'd never be able to find that quotation again. But students don't take that journey anymore. Doing research, especially for undergrads, consists entirely of sitting down at a computer, going to Google Scholar, typing in a subject, and scanning the results. Scholarship doesn't exist between book covers anymore, nor does it exist as issues in a journal you can leaf through. For students entering university today, peer-reviewed material just appears as hits on a list, just like any other search results do. It might be a book or a thesis or an article, but they all look pretty much the same. It's as if all this material is bound in a single volume called Google, dated today. We didn't help make this distinction between websites and academic materials any clearer when we digitized everything we could get our hands on. At one point, there was a clear distinction. There's trusted material in your library, then the crazy, wild, woolly web that you could never be sure about, but most of it was probably lies. But now you can search Google for websites or for serious academic articles and books. You can read entire academic monographs through Google. There are some very well-regarded journals that exist only on the web and never come into the library in a physical sense at all. To the untrained eye, all this content looks pretty much the same. If you want to quote a website, you put the web address as the citation. That makes perfect sense. You find that quote again by clicking on the link. Many students find all kinds of great, relevant, academic material through, say, Google Scholar or their library's series of databases, and they figure you can find the text they quoted if they give you the link to it, just like every other web page. Everything else in their browser works that way. Why shouldn't this? Unfortunately, the link they give you is usually massive and unstable, so you can click on it, but it won't go anywhere. So instructors get frustrated that students apparently didn't read the instructions on how to cite academic material. But it's frustrating on both sides. It seems obvious to us that you need to cite an article as a published work with a regular citation, and you don't even need to add the link from your browser's navigation bar to make it a correct citation. But the concept of a published work as distinct from every other kind of web content is rapidly becoming a broken metaphor. There are databases, there are websites, there are journals and books. An article is, in fact, a web object with a web ID. It's also published scholarship that belongs to an issue and to a journal. So everyone's right, and no one is happy. So even constructing a citation is becoming confusing now that scholarship is increasingly digital. Maybe it should be confusing. Maybe we shouldn't do it at all. It's machine work. It really is. Constructing the map back to where something came from is easy work for machines, and we should probably just let them take care of it. A machine knows what kind of document it is, who wrote it, and what citation style this instructor or this journal prefers. In the future, I'm quite sure you'll add a citation just by hovering over it in an e-reader, or it will come along into your manuscript when you copy and paste it. We won't worry about commas and italics in the future. Formatting is for machines to take care of. They'll get it right every single time. But there's more to it than that. How do we communicate what you're meant to cite in the first place? It's relatively easy when you're quoting someone. We all know you need to cite a quotation. We cite quotations on tattoos and t-shirts. We get that part. But what about ideas? It comes back to our constant conversations about plagiarism and making it clear to students what they're meant to cite and what it's okay not to. I've seen this explained dozens of different ways, framed largely in terms of violation, theft, or credibility. Behind it all, there's the hovering threat of being accused of academic dishonesty if you get it wrong. There's a lot of confusion on this point. When, where, and how should undergraduate students cite what they've read? It's as if we're treading on new ground with them, isn't it? As if students have no concept at all about what it means to produce work that's built on the work of others. But that's not actually true. Not at all. Most undergraduate students entering universities now know exactly how to cite what they read and create new things out of what they've read. And they know how to do it in a variety of ways depending on the context. They know how to abide by the rules of the culture in which they find themselves. They know exactly why you shouldn't publish something based on someone else's work without giving credit to the original author. I know they understand this quite well, because they do it all the time on social media. Citation is framed in metaphors on social media that are not broken. When Twitter first hit the scene, there was no way to retweet things. All Twitter let users do officially was post 140 characters. But the sense that you don't copy someone else's words without citing them was so strong in the user base that the users themselves invented a way to cite each other. You'd paste the tweet you liked, but you'd include the username of the person who said it first, which turned it into a link, and you indicated that it was a quote with the abbreviation RT for retweet. That way, the attribution was clear, and it allowed others to track back to the original tweeter and tweet. It's a citation, and it was immediately clear how and when to use it. Over time, the retweet custom became institutionalized, and Twitter built in a function to automatically retweet tweets along with a complete citation, not only back to the user who said it, but to the actual tweet itself. Twitter now has a simple button that creates a complete, perfect, formatted, crystal clear citation so that users can share what they think is pithy or funny or true without ever treading down the path of plagiarizing anyone. Ask students what they think of someone tweeting someone's terrific tweet as a paste without attribution, without retweeting. They will probably articulate everything you want to say about why it's important to cite the authors of the academic work they read. Another terrific example of baked-in citation in social media is the reblogging function on Tumblr. If you're not already familiar with Tumblr, here's a quick summary. Tumblr is a blogging platform where users follow each other, as they do on Twitter, and the Tumblr interface, called the dashboard, allows you to see all the posts that your followers are posting. What Tumblr does that's really different is that it provides essentially no mechanism to leave comments on posts by others. You can't just comment. If you want to engage with somebody else's work, you have to take that content and post it on your own blog. At first, that seems like the opposite of what we're trying to get across when it comes to plagiarism and original work, but it gets more complicated. Custom on Tumblr is to reblog things that you like or want to talk about. But reblogging it doesn't just add the content to your blog. It maintains the history of the content, showing you where it started and where you got it from and all the steps in between. When you post something and someone else reblogs it, you get a notification, and everyone who looks at your original post will see all the notifications indicating who reblogged it, who reblogged it and added commentary or images, and who liked it. So you, as the original poster, gather all this feedback and attention every time someone else reblogs your work. Each post becomes a kind of collaborative portfolio of all the people who had something to say about it or thought it was noteworthy. You can click through the whole history of the post and see it grow and change as commentary and reaction GIFs get added to it. Someone reblogging your post isn't stealing your content. They're amplifying your signal, giving you attention, and increasing a little number in the corner of your post that gives you a sense of how popular it is. Does this sound familiar? Tumblr is like scholarly communication on Red Bull and speed with animated GIFs. Each post has its impact metric baked right in. It's utterly fascinating. I know Tumblr has a reputation for being fairly silly, but look at it from the perspective of plagiarism and citation, as a space where people collaboratively build things and expect to have their contributions noted. Someone posts something, another person reblogs it with a funny caption, another person creates a series of animated GIFs to articulate their reaction to the image and the caption, and other people make jokes or comments as tags in the post, and all of this work can be seen as a whole. Or you can peel the layers back and see its whole history, all its versions. Everyone who contributes is cited, right there in every version of the post, including the original one. The system as it's built is allowing all that citation to happen with the way it tracks who added what and maintaining all the links to the originals. But in the end, it's the user base that uses those tools, and it's the users who enforce their use. One of the most fascinating things I've ever seen is what happens on Tumblr if a blogger takes another blogger's content and blogs it as if it's original, instead of reblogging it the way you're meant to. Doing that breaks the chain of notifications and removes the contribution of those whose ideas it was built on. It's plagiarism. On some level, on the individual blog, it doesn't look that different, but it cuts the original author off from getting feedback, from getting credit, and from all those notifications about their own content. It halts the impact metric on the original post from going higher. It's like theft. And Tumblr bloggers get very upset about it. It's anathema. This is ostracization level stuff. Tumblr users will shame each other into deleting reposted material. They will form digital mobs and raise the alarm that someone has done the wrong thing. Plagiarism is not okay on Tumblr. Not citing the work that inspired you is not okay. And those bloggers, most of them under the age of, say, 22, will make sure you know it. Maybe it's time we started to talk about citation in terms of retweeting and reblogging. Not just because it's the language that undergrads understand these days, but because those metaphors are more in keeping with the form our work now takes. Scholarship is living digital material now. It's escaped from between the covers of all those books in the stacks. Maybe it's time our metaphors around plagiarism and citation did the same. That's it for this episode. Do you think it's time to reframe the citation discussion? Let us know by posting a comment at the bottom of this podcast page at universityaffairs.ca. Until next time, I'm Rochelle Mazar.